Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Alan Day. Alan started the first government-sponsored wild horse sanctuary in the United States. After successfully lobbying Congress to approve the idea, Alan received 1,500 wild horses in 1989 from the Bureau of Land Management. Alan and I will be discussing his recently released memoir, The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the World Mustangs. Good morning, Alan. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm just fine. It's a beautiful day, and I'm happy to be talking to you.
Fantastic. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. The Horse Lover is a wonderful, easy read. It's beautifully written. Congratulations to you and your co-author.
Well, thank you. Have you read it all, Johnny?
Portions of it. It's from the heart, and that's what I like about it. That's what a memoir needs to be. It's easy to connect. I love the conversations that you have with the various people. I particularly like the descriptions that you give. And that's one of the things that I wanted to discuss this morning, about walking us through the process of you writing the memoir and the things that you've encountered and experienced in life that you've put in the book.
Well, good. I'm anxious to do just that.
Fantastic. So let us start by getting to know you a little bit better. Kind of give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I was born and raised on a large, dry desert ranch in southeast Arizona, and a little, some of it in New Mexico, and just was raised up. My dad was a rancher before me. His father settled there in 1880, so my heritage was there, and I really never thought about being anything other than a rancher. I just was, that was my world, and I was raised up in that. Since I've ended up later in life selling the ranch, I didn't have any children. I do have children, but they weren't interested in the ranch, and none of my relatives, none of my nephews or anything were interested in the ranch. And so later in life, I ended up selling the ranch because it's real discouraging to live there all your life and know that the day you're gone, that the ranch just disbands. You know, it's not, nobody will step up and then take it from there. So I decided, you know, late in life that a lot of physical work was hard to do, gets harder as you get older, and so decided to turn a chapter. So sold that ranch and the other two that I had acquired, and live in Tucson now, and have an interesting life. I write books, as you know, but have a little company, a little real estate company that we buy rundown houses and fix them up and sell them, and you know, stay busy, but not at ranching anymore.
My exposure to ranching was when I met my American foster family in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. One of their sons, compared to what you guys have, he just had a very small ranch in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and he had beef cattle.
Yeah.
That's where I rode my first horse, actually. And it was kind of fun, but it was nerve-wracking being on a horse, and all of a sudden right now you're way up in the air. And that was my first exposure to all that.
That can be a little daunting to get on such a powerful animal and not quite know what they're doing. So
I
can relate to that.
Yes, it's quite an experience. I enjoyed it because I just came to the United States, and so that was just a wonderful experience for me in the sense that I've always watched those cowboy movies and so forth, and now having the opportunity to kind of experience it, at least if nothing else, for 3 weeks or so.
Yeah. Well, you know, the romantic image of that we get in the movies is it's not mm-hmm. nearly that romantic when you live it day in and day out. I'm sure you can imagine that.
Right, right. When I read the stories that you have in the book in terms of the people you encounter and have a wonderful, I guess, ranch manager, a foreman that handles everything, knowing what needs to get done, and then you got all this hired help in terms of, you know, their family, basically, in a sense, because
yeah.
it's a close-knit group of people that love, in some ways, you have to have the passion to do what you're doing.
Absolutely. Everybody that was on the ranch really
yeah.
loves the ranching experience, and otherwise
yeah.
they just wouldn't be there.
Precisely, precisely. And it's so
no.
sad to know that, I mean, it's a dying breed because there's continuity right now in terms of, like you're talking about, the generations and generations afterwards and so forth.
Yeah, it's sad to see family-owned ranches and farms, you know, sell to big corporations or for development
mm-hmm.
or what all. It's it seems to happen, but it doesn't really make me happy.
Yeah, it's not quite the same. How has ranching contributed to your life experiences and education?
Well, I went to college, actually graduated with good grades, but my real education was out on the ground, you know, learning the cattle and learning the grass.
Right.
Where my heart really resides is I discovered over a lot of years that I really love trying to understand grass. I have an affinity for grass, and I like to try to figure out what makes grass happy and healthy, and actually that really does apply to ranching, because if you can have happy, healthy grass, you'll have a good ranch. And actions that man does can have a huge effect on how good the grass is, how happy it is. And so I kind of was drawn to grass,
mm-hmm.
and it's really the basis. I mean, if you have horses, if you have cattle, what you're really doing is grazing the grass and then selling that product, you know, the animal,
mm-hmm.
or you know, you ultimately sell the grass. And so if you're a good
yeah.
grass farmer, if you really grow good, healthy grass, you have a lot of product to sell. That was my real education, and I got most of that after I got out of college.
That's wonderful. Well, you learn life, learn living. That's one thing that I got from meeting the people that work on the ranch. Living within that close-knit, dealing with the animals every day, it's a sense of education that no one else could really understand and appreciate. And, of course, sort of, for lack of a better term, commuting with nature, because you have to understand earth, and like to talk about the grass, the weather, and everything else. I mean, you're much more in tune than, say, someone who lives in the city or not in the business of needing to understand the elements of nature.
Yes, and really the more you can learn in that area, then the more successful you'll be. So there's a really
mm-hmm.
direct correlation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Fantastic. Let's talk about your book. What brought you to South Dakota?
Well, I had a long answer. I'll try to keep it not long, but the ranch in Arizona was 76% government-owned, and we leased
mm-hmm.
the grazing rights on that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that's what I grew up with. That was what my world was, you know, had a lot of government-owned land that we leased,
mm-hmm.
and as a consequence, we had to answer to the government for almost every action we did. And so I learned that probably 25% of my job was just dealing with the government. And
mm-hmm.
sometimes that's good, sometimes not as good. Once in a while, they come up with some ideas that seem not too practical. And
mm-hmm.
so, but a lot of my ranching experience involved dealing with the government, and so I gradually came to a position where I thought, gee whiz, a lot of the government bureaucrats really don't want ranchers out there. They don't like ranchers. Mm-hmm. And if my family's going to stay in the ranching business, I probably need to get a ranch that doesn't have any government land on it, that's all mm-hmm. owned, you know, deeded land, not owned by the government. So
right.
I took a long time looking and finally found a ranch in Nebraska that was all deeded, no government land at all, and succeeded in buying that. And I was very happy there. It had actually more cattle on it than my home ranch in Arizona, and mm-hmm. had a lot more grass than that dry desert ranch in Arizona. And so I was happy there, but a friend of mine started calling me and saying, Alan, you need to come up here to South Dakota to look at this ranch. You think that ranch where you are is a good ranch, but this one's a really good ranch. And I turned him down again and again and again, but he was so persistent that I finally agreed to go up there and look at that ranch, mostly just to get him off my back, you know, to keep him from calling me all the time. And so he was right. I, as I drove into that ranch, I just completely fell in love with it and felt like I had been there in another life. I just felt like I was at home, like I was coming home from a long trip. Mm-hmm. And so I was instantly just completely in love with that piece of land. And so even though the two ranches I was actively running was a huge job, mm-hmm. I called my partners and said, wow, I've just had an incredible experience, and this is an amazing ranch, and, you know, can we talk about acquiring it? And I had such wonderful partners. They, after I explained it, they said, well, if you think you can borrow that much money, go ahead and borrow and buy it. We trust you. Mm-hmm. And so be careful what you ask for. You might get it.
Right.
So
right.
I actually was able to, the ranch was in bad financial condition. The previous owner had a alcohol problem and wasn't a good ranch manager. And so I was able to buy it just ahead of the bank foreclosure. You know, the bank was about to mm-hmm. take it, mm-hmm. and I kind of bought the bank out and got the ranch, and then had quite a job. It was, what I saw was potential there, not actuality.
Yeah.
It was kind of run down, and the fences were poor, and the wells were broken down, and it was in not good shape, but I could see how much potential was there and was just mm-hmm. thrilled to be associated with that. So I got that ranch, but the previous owner, in trying to keep the bank away, had sold all the cattle and then spent all the money, mm-hmm. and so I bought the ranch with no cattle on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so then I had to think, well, what should I do with this? Should I put cattle back on it? You know, right after my predecessor had gone broke trying to run cattle, or should I be entrepreneurial and try something else? And as luck would have it, an opportunity just landed right in my lap to take these wild horses, these excess, unadoptable wild horses, and give them the best home they'd ever had. And so the idea came up through Dayton Hyde, and he and I then put our heads together and decided that he had a ranch about 120 miles away and smaller ranch, and together between us we could take care of almost 2,000 mm-hmm. of these excess unadoptable horses that the government had and didn't know what to do with.
Yeah.
So we proposed to, the government had them in feedlots and were paying mm-hmm. the feedlot mm-hmm. operators just daily fees to feed them. And mm-hmm. we told the BLM that for less than half the cost that they were spending in the feedlots, we would turn them out on the best grass that they'd ever been on, and these would be happy horses running free again out over the prairie. And and the horses in the feedlots were sad to see because they're crowded together so much. I call it horse prison. And they're crowded together so much that the family units break down, and they can't, you know, they're not they're not abused, but they're just, they're in prison there. And so when we turned them back out on the prairie, the family units could hook up again, and they could have their little family units and run and play and graze on the prairie like they should. So that's what we made happen, and it was thrilling. It was a thrilling experience to see that take shape, we spent the better part of a year fixing up the ranch and drilling new wells and fixing up the corrals and the fences and getting the pastures ready and undoing some of the neglect that had happened before us. And then it was just thrilling and exciting to start receiving the horses. So that was really the highlight of my whole ranching career, was dreaming that up and then see it come to reality and having that beautiful, beautiful rolling grass land up there with beautiful wet meadows and hay production, and have that and have those horses come and be as happy as they were out on the range. It was just a thrilling experience.
Well, sir, your labor of love is wonderfully written in the book. And the reason I asked you about the description of the place, because you did it very well in the book. And I wanted our listeners to hear it from you. And not only that, to kind of connect with you because of the passion that you have for what you did. This is something very, very special. I know it's very dear and close to your heart. Throughout the entire book, I can see snippets of it. You included some wonderful photos in the book. I have some questions about that later, about specific photos.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to kind of paint this wonderful, beautiful picture about your dream, your vision for that particular area that you saw. And also being able to bring in this beautiful animals in and create a win-win deal for everyone.
Yeah. Well, it was, and I would take just a minute, if you don't mind,
sure,
and describe.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
When you drive in the ranch, that you drive off the highway and drive about 6 miles, and you get on the ranch. And when you get on the ranch, there are these rolling grassy hills with no trees or anything, but just solid grass, so thick that you can't even see the ground. You know, just you can see this waving grass in the breeze, and on the way in, the ranch has 3,000 acres of sub-irrigated meadow, meaning the groundwater comes right up to the surface, and so these meadows are even more lush than the hills. The hills are really beautiful grass, but then the meadow, amazing, 26 varieties of grass grow on those meadows, and just beautiful green waving grass, and we cut hay on the meadows. And when I bought the ranch, well, the history was it would cut about 1 ton of hay per acre on those meadows. So with 3,000 acres, that was 3,000 tons of hay, if you can imagine. But I did some soil testing when I first got the ranch and discovered we were a little short on phosphorus. And so we bought some fertilizer to spread on the meadow. And then we did some different practices from what the previous owners had done. They would cut the hay and haul it off the meadow and then in the winter feed it up on the hills. And what that was doing is that was taking the nutrients away from the meadow and spreading them up on the hills. And I said, we're not going to do that. We cut all this hay here on the meadows. We're going to feed it on the meadows, and it'll get recycled right back into the meadows that are so productive. And so with the phosphorus that we put on there and then recycle feeding on the meadow so that the manure from the horses would fertilize the meadow, we got the hay production clear up to 2 tons per acre by just that that small amount of change.
Mm-hmm.
But the meadows just came to life and really started smiling. It's the only way I can describe it, you know. But
yes.
The production
yes.
just doubled, and the grass mm-hmm. was greener and thicker, and, you know, it was really neat to see that come alive. And the meadow,
sure.
by the way, when you come in on the ranch road, you come into the meadow and then follow the meadow along for a couple of miles before you get to the ranch, and a stream runs right down through the middle of the meadow and meanders down past the headquarters and off out into the distance. And it is such a beautiful sight, for the grassy hills on each side and that just lush meadow that you come in and you go alongside the meadow, and then you cross over the creek and alongside the meadow on the other side into the headquarters. And it never failed to take my breath away how pretty that was.
It's beautiful, and the only experience I have in terms of, like I was telling you in the beginning of the show, where in terms of ranching and being able to see beautiful countryside was up in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, where it is a beautiful area. And the ranch that my American family's son had backs into the Ozark Mountains. So
yeah.
you have the wonderful hills and streams and everything else. Believe me, I can just picture how beautiful meadow is where you were at in South Dakota at that time. So I can certainly understand the romance, the love story that began afterwards from that standpoint of view.
Yeah, that's just the way it happened. So
wonderful. How many wild Mustangs are there in the U.S. today?
Well, you have to understand that depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a different answer. Some of the horse lovers claim that the government is trying to kill all the horses and there aren't
yeah.
enough, and then others claim that there's too many horses and that the government misses the guess. The government estimate is there are 179 separate herds in the United States, and their total is, by government estimate, is 49,000
wow.
right now. And but the I need to digress a minute, or not digress, I need to follow that
yeah.
up and say
yeah.
that the biggest problem is that the horses overproduce. They breed so rapidly that the herds increase in numbers every year, and some estimates are as high as 20% per year. And I think different herds increase at different rates.
Sure.
But in any case, they breed, and if an area is maybe suitable for 100 horses, you leave them alone a few years and you have 200 horses there. You know,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
over time, they will increase to such a degree that then there's not enough grass for them, and they'll all starve to death because they
yeah.
overgraze because they're overpopulated. And so the government has quite a problem because the Bureau of Land Management is entrusted to manage the horses, but
yeah.
also to manage the land. And
yeah.
if you overgraze the land severely, you can do damage that would last 100 years. And so they're caught in kind of a trap. The horse lovers don't want them to leave the horses alone, but then the land is saying, help me, don't let
yeah.
me get overgrazed. And so
right.
it's quite a problem. And but they've gathered so many of the excess horses
yeah.
that they now have almost as many excess horses that they've taken off of the range as they have on the range. So there's close to 49,000 that are termed excess horses that the government is just leasing land for them to run on, just what I started. I had the first of those
yeah.
of those sanctuaries.
Mm-hmm.
And some people in Oklahoma have really picked up on that, and they almost all of the excess, or a big portion of the excess, goes to Oklahoma on those ranches. And so I was dealing with 2,000 head. They now have to deal with 49,000 head. That's
wow.
what the excess, that's what
yeah.
happens.
Yeah.
So
wait.
kind of a sad overall picture. And what they need to do is some birth control, you know, get the population fill them out, but get the population growth to be a zero population growth, stabilize it.
Yeah, yeah. And for a while, anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they're doing some work with that, but the horses, a lot of the ranges where the horses are very steep and rocky and hard to get around on, and so the hardest thing is to gather them in order to cut some out, you know, to take some off the range. It's quite a problem to get them gathered. And so that's what the big national picture in wild horses is right now.
Very interesting.
And
thank you for sharing that with us. Sure it is. I mean, you can't go to the extreme on each side. They have to find a balance in the middle here somewhere. And you're right in terms of preserving the breed. And then at the same time, how do you handle extremes on both sides to make sure that the intention works, so to speak? One of the things that you did, obviously, you took the so-called unadoptable horses, and eventually you had a huge number of them that are adoptable. So you do spend above and beyond what I would consider, if someone's just in it for, perhaps for lack of a better term here, for the money, where, okay, I have X amount of land, just bring those horses here and let them run wild. You have a little different approach to it because you're very passionate about the relationship that a man has with the horses. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I've always loved horses, and the very first horse I ever rode was a little Mustang that had been captured out of a wild horse herd that ran near my home ranch at Lazy Bee. Mm-hmm. And Chico was kind of a small horse, but was just my best friend for, 10 years when I was growing up. And he took care of me. He babysat me at least as much as my mother did. And, you know, Chico and I, he was my best friend. When I was old enough to saddle him and get on and ride, well, I could ride anywhere I wanted. My parents said, if you're big enough to saddle and get on, then open the gate and you can go wherever you want. And so they weren't worried, you know, that I'd get out and get lost or anything. And so Chico and I would go out and have these adventures, you know, and I'd be the penultimate cowboy, and I'd rope the wild cattle, and then the next time we'd play cowboys and Indians, and I'd be the cavalry chasing the Indians, or the next time I'd be the Indian outsmarting the cavalry. And so I just, you know, I had a storybook childhood with a wonderful horse as a companion. So I've loved horses all my life, and then when the wild horses started arriving at the ranch, well, it was so easy to just fall in love with them and fall in love with what we were doing and just admire the horses and, you know, be happy to be a part of their life and have them. One of the really, really nice things was I put in a training process. When they arrived, their comfort level with man was maybe a mile, meaning that if you got closer than a mile to them, they'd try to run off. They would run off. They wouldn't try to. They would do it. And
wow.
I wanted to teach them that I was their friend. And, you know, actually, man is their worst enemy. Man is the one that has terrorized them and chased them with helicopters and forced them into corrals and split up their families. And so all of the bad things that have happened in their lives prior to coming to our sanctuary, it was man that was terrorizing them and their worst enemy. So I had to reverse that process and say, look, maybe the other men did bad things to you, but I won't, and you need to trust me, and I need to trust you, and we need to get acquainted. And we made that happen. We had a training process that we got near to them and talked to them nicely and didn't make threatening actions toward them and didn't terrorize them. And they actually were very happy to offer their friendship when they finally discovered that we weren't out there to terrorize them. And they were happy to offer their friendship. And once they give you their friendship, they never take it back. You know, they always are friendly to you. So that was if I had to pick one single action that was the most thrilling, it was that training process and then the action when they say, okay, I accept you as a friend. That is just, wow, that is so neat to be a part of that.
That's fantastic. Why I wanted you to explain all that, because when it's all said and done, even we humans, everything starts out with respect for one another. And what you did, you respected the horse, you respected the space that the horse is in, and you respect the horse in terms of it matters. And from there, you build trust. And then, like you were saying, cooperation just simply is the end product of that basic formula.
And one thing that, back to the grass again, I loved having the horses, but I wanted to treat the grass with respect as well, so I needed to do rest rotation grazing. You know, graze the grass for a while, but then get the horses off of it and let it rest and let it recover.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, I needed to move the horses around the ranch on a regular basis, like almost every week. They'd be in a new pasture, and they'd go to a new pasture. And I didn't want to have to chase them all over the, you know, and have a big horse race and have them running and terrorized. So I wanted to train them that when I came through the pasture and was horseback and I'd say, come on, boys, follow me, that then they would just throw in behind me and follow me to the next pasture and not try to run off, but trust me to take them to fresh pasture and green feed. And so we were able to teach them that. And that, talk about a thrill, when you ride through, let's say it's a 3,000-acre pasture and the horses are scattered all over. Well, we didn't have to gather them up or anything. I'd just get on my old horse, Clyde, ride through the middle of them, and they'd throw up their head and say, oh, it's you. What do you want? That was the look they'd give me. And I'd say, come on, boys, follow me. And I'd hit an easy little gallop, kaloop gallop, and they'd just throw in behind me, and they'd be 8 feet behind me, all 1,500 of them just strung out behind me. And it was so thrilling, and you could hear the thunder of the hooves and the breathing and the nickering. And I'd just gallop through the pasture and have the gate open into the next pasture and go through there, and they'd go through, and then they'd spread out and kind of look up at me and say thanks, and I'd go on. And I can't even describe how much the adrenaline would run and just how thrilling that was. And we did it again and again and again, and it was always just a total thrill. Fun times.
Those are the wonderful, rewarding moments that you have experienced. And it's probably touched you in many different ways that few people ever had the chance to experience, if any, because you took the time. And it's a unique experience, the relationship that you have built with the horses. I mean, it's one thing to have a domesticated horse, but to have the wild horses and you having mutual respect for one another and the trust, that's something else.
Yeah, it just, every day wasn't a surprise, but every day was just you'd learn something more about them. You'd feel closer to them. So it was a it was a growing experience for both the horses and for me, for us. And my foreman, John Pitkin, it was kind of funny. It was harder to train the cowboys than it was the horses because the cowboys have grown up. And they have a certain way of doing things, and their way is you force your will on the cows or the horses. And I said, no, we're going to make friends with them, and we're going to ask them to be friends, and we're going to do it this way. And it was harder for the cowboys to learn that than it was the horses. John got it. John just, instantly said, oh, boy, this is neat. But some of the cowboys just were... we got to round them suckers up. and it wasn't that way,
Well, Alan, you came across as a sensitive cowboy. You can't blame them because that's part of their conditioning. That's what they are used to with the cattle.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's exactly right. So But we all had to learn from each other. You know, we had to learn from the horses. They had to teach us how to be their friend.
Right, right. Wonderful.
So,
were there other challenges that you had faced? I know that the book talked about your relationship with the BLM as well. So tell us a little bit about that. It's interesting because when I read that section of the book, it reminds me of the general being so far away from the battlefield, telling the foot soldier that having the bullets flying all over him, how to shoot his rifle or how to manage his war.
Yeah. Well, and you hit the nail on the head. A lot of the decisions that were made with the BLM were made out of Washington, and those guys have never been out in the field. They've never been out where the problem is or where the horses are.
Situation. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, so many of the problems could be handled if they made the decision where the problem is, out on the ground, not in Washington, you know.
Right.
But bureaucracy is what it is. So we had problems. I've got a real good program. I mean, real good story that illustrates it.
Go ahead. Please do so. Yes, please go ahead.
We had just received most of the horses. I mean, we hadn't really finished training them yet, but we'd been receiving horses a lot, and some horses started dying, and you know, like two a week were dying, and they weren't the older horses, they weren't thin, they weren't, you know, no discernible reason why these horses were dying. And I got very alarmed, and so had a really good veterinarian that was nearby, you know, not too far away, so I called Bill and I said, can you come out? And one thing, when we would find one, when one would die, if they stayed overnight dead, the next morning the coyotes would have just eaten everything up. Mm-hmm. There was just bones left the next day. So you couldn't leave them out overnight and then go and do a postmortem because there wasn't enough to do a postmortem on the next day. I told the cowboys, I said, keep good watch, and when one dies, well, Bill Burford is on alert, and he'll come, you know, right then. He'll drop everything he's doing, and he'll come right then, and we'll do a postmortem to see what killed the horse. So we did, and one died. And so Bill, I was there with him, and so he rolled the horse up and cut into the stomach. The very first thing he did is cut in the stomach and open up the stomach. And he said, well, there's your problem. It's easy to see. He's full of worms.
Mm.
And there's many, many kinds of worms, 15 or 20 different varieties of worms that horses can get.
Mm.
And I think we had three or four different varieties in this horse that he was examining. But he said, well, that's what killed the horse, is these stomach worms. So I was infuriated for a number of reasons, but the biggest was, with our cows and horses on the ranch there, we never had any worms. There were no worms in that area. And part of the cycle in a worm's life is they drop out of the animal and they burrow into the ground, and then they go in the pupa stage, and then they come out of the ground as a fly, and then they sting the horse and they go back in the horse. So it's a the worm cycle includes the ground. And what had happened is they brought worms into our world where we never had any worms, and they infected our ground with worms. And that really infuriated me, because I was very careful when we made the contract with the BLM, and I stipulated that every horse be wormed with a systemic wormer before they shipped him to us, because I didn't want worms in my ground. And here they were, you know, so they were doing damage to the land by bringing the worms in. So I went, as soon as I found that out, I went and called the Bureau of Land Management, and I said, you sent me wormy horses in spite of the fact that you were under contract to send me clean horses. And I said, we've got to worm all these horses. We don't know which ones have worms, so we have to worm every one of them, and I'm going to do it next Tuesday. And they replied and said, well, we can't do that. we don't have the money allocated, and you can't do it in a day anyway, and no, you know, we're not going to do it. And I said, well, yes, you are, because I already have the worm medicine ordered, and yes, we're going to do it next Tuesday, and yes, we can do it in one day. We have these horses trained. And they'll walk up the chute for us, and they won't be frightened, and they won't run backwards and turn over backwards and fight the chute.
Right.
They'll walk right through the chute, and we'll vaccinate them and turn them out. And they said, well, we've been in the horse business for 30 years, and it would take us 5 days to vaccinate those horses. And I said, well, you're about to learn something. You know, send some of your people up. Tell them to stay out of my way. Tell them to stay up on the fence and
right.
watch. And they're going to see something they've never seen.
Right.
And so sure enough, the next Tuesday, we brought the horses in, and they didn't panic or run backwards or, you know, have any fright or anything. They just filed up the chute, and we walked along and vaccinated them and turned them out. And about 2 o'clock, we were done. And so the Bureau, the guys there were just astounded, you know, because it when the horses are so frightened, it's very difficult
right.
to force them up the chute, and, you know, you work hard and all that. And they said, well, that's, you know, the darndest thing we ever saw. They said, can you teach us that? And being a bit of a smart boy, I said, well, you know, why is it you've been in the business 40 years and I've been in the business 6 months and you're asking me to teach you? What's wrong with this picture here?
Yeah.
You know, well, they didn't like that answer, obviously, and I shouldn't have been such a smart mouth on that. But one of them came up and said, well, could you teach us? And I said, yes, I can teach you how to handle these horses, and I'm happy to.
Yeah.
But the government being the bureaucracy, they never followed up. They never came and said, we can learn from you.
Yeah.
So,
you
know, you ask some of the problems, well, you know, when the government is this big bureaucracy and the bureaucracy is cranking along and then you're trying to deal with it, it can be difficult.
Right, right. So true. I understand where you're coming from. I mean, that's unfortunate, but this is where systems doesn't always work for everything. It takes individual ingenuity to make things work.
Well,
so
it does, and a last, not really a shot, but the last comment I'll make is I could have ended up writing a, you know, an expose, if you would, or a beat-up on the government book about, you know, about dumb things or thoughtless things
that they did. Yeah.
But I didn't want to do that. There's plenty of those books out, and they're not very good reading. And I really wanted to have a book that was about the horses. So those are some of the things that happened, and I've related those, but I don't go into great detail about beating up on the government.
Sure.
I'd rather just stick to the horse stories.
And they're a wonderful horse story. I want us to talk about these captured moments, the pictures that you've shared. Not all the pictures. Certainly I picked up a few pictures that I thought that was really, really moving. So let us start with the first picture. Horses galloping towards Mud Lake, and you have it beautifully illustrated on page 147 for us.
Yes. Well, you know, that was, again, that was, we had taught them to stay in a group and follow the leader, meaning the man who's the leader, and an easy little gallop and just take them wherever we wanted. And so that picture just shows how it works. And you know, how the horses string out and the leaders are right behind the man on horseback. Sometimes there would be two of us. That particular day, John Pitkin and I were up in the lead, the two of us, not just one. But later, when we were just going from one pasture to another, it would just be one man in the lead. And but anyway, yeah, that picture shows it the way it is.
The next one is on page 153, a colt trying to keep up with his mama. I thought that was really cute.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably the funnest, the most laughter that I had the whole time I was up there was that day when we moved the horses over to Mud Lake one day. It was for the start of summer grazing, and the move was 6 miles. And some of the mares that they had brought to us were in foal, meaning, you know, that they were going to have a baby.
Right.
And the day before we moved them the 6 miles, this one mare had her colt. And so the colt was only 1 day old. And long, spindly legs and wobbly, and, you know, 1 day old colt is fun to look at, but they're not very coordinated, and, you know, they kind of wobble around, and, you know, they need a few days to kind of get their feet on the ground and learn what's going on. But we had to move the horses that day, so we started off, and I kind of knew this would happen, and so as we get maybe a third of the way along, well, this colt can't keep up, you know, because we're in this easy gallop, and he, 1 day old, he gets tired. So he kept dropping back, and his mom would run up to the group, and then she'd nicker at him, and then she'd go back and get him and say, hurry, hurry, and he would do the best he could, but he was dropping further behind. So one of my partners, it was a big day. We were anxious to see how our process worked and whether the horses would follow us in open range or whether they'd break and run or what. So Ralph Stinson was coming along, and he wasn't horseback. He didn't ride, but he was thrilled to be one of the partners. So he was driving a Suburban, an old Chevy Suburban, and following the group. But I told him, stay way back and, you know, don't disturb the horses, but you can follow along. So when the colt got clearly was so tired he couldn't go on, I called one of my cowboys over, and I said, go back, catch that colt, tie him down, and put him in the back of the Suburban, and Ralph can bring him along, and when we get to Mud Lake, we'll let him up. So Russ said, okay, and he went back, but he didn't tie him down. He just put him in the back of the Suburban. So 10 minutes later, I look back, and he's climbed up in the front seat with Ralph, and he's sitting there like a big Dalmatian dog right next to Ralph in the front seat of that Suburban. And I thought I was going to fall off my horse laughing, and Ralph would drive along and look at him and think, how could he be here, and what could I do? And Ralph was just panicked. He didn't know what to do. And then the mother of the colt saw the colt in the Suburban, and she had a tantrum, and she attacked the Suburban. And so she ran at the Suburban, got right to it. Ralph slammed on the brakes and honked at her. She wheeled around and kicked the grill of the Suburban clear out with both hind feet, just destroyed the grill. And I was watching all that because I was up in the lead, and I was just trying to not fall off my horse because of laughing so hard. And so we went on and got all the way to Mud Lake, and Ralph drove up, and Mama was still there. She knew that that colt was in the Suburban. She could see him there, and so I went over there and opened the door, and the colt kind of tumbled out and got up and went over and mothered up with his mama, and the mama gave us a look that I'll never forget, and that look said, don't you ever ask to babysit my baby again. She was really mad. So it was just such a, I don't know, just such a lovely moment and a fun, funny moment.
Sure.
I just love that story.
Well, again, it builds around trust and respect as well, and that's the beauty of it. In hindsight, it's just a wonderful story. Alan, you're back?
Johnny?
Yes.
I'm back. I'm sorry about that. I think my battery takes that long.
Yeah, no problem at all. We were talking about the picture of Happy on page 208.
Yeah, well, Happy was our poster boy. He was the most colorful horse in the whole 1500. He was the largest horse we had, probably weighed 1,200 pounds, and he was black and white paint, but the black was just shiny black, and the white was just the purest white you ever saw. And so when people would come out and look at the herd, they'd always pick him out and say, well, what's that horse there? And he was a funny... He was a funny boy. He was not a member of a family. All of our, not all, but almost all of our horses would be a member of a little family. family of maybe 10 or 15 within the big group, you know, and they'd have their little family structure. But we had some loners, and Happy was one of the loners. So he would always be kind of at the outskirts of the herd and not with any other particular horses.
Yeah.
So one thing, he was always easy to spot because he'd be on the outside of the herd. But also then, when we'd go to move the herd, he wouldn't really try to get away, but he'd just kind of wander off to the side, and sometimes you'd have to go over there and kind of shoo him back in the bunch, and we'd always say, Happy, you know, now stop trying to get away. Well, he wasn't trying to get away, but he was just, you know, just kind of on his own, you know, out there. And he was kind of a character. And one time, and again, I never did understand this, but the BLM decided he was such a show horse that one day they called me and they said, can you get Happy up and get him in the corral? And I said, yeah, I can bring Happy in. They said, well, we're going to come and get him in a trailer, and we're going to haul him up to Flathead Lake, Montana, and we're going to put him on a barge and take him out to the island that's in the Flathead Lake, Montana, and turn him loose on that island. And I said, well, why are you going to do that? And they said, well, because we choose to. So that's exactly what happened. And I always wanted to go visit Happy up on that island in Flathead Lake and just see that he was content up there. And I, to this day, don't. They never did explain to me why they made that decision and spent the money and the time to do that. But I hope that the fishermen around there, you know, appreciated him, and that he would stand up on a rock, and that people could see him there and appreciate him.
Very interesting. And the final photo that you had, which is, I guess, so fitting, horses at sunset on page 239.
Yes. Well, you know, any time that you just wanted to have a feel-good moment, wait till just at sunset and go out there with the horses and just bond with them and see the sun go down and see them just kind of relax and get ready for their night. Horses a lot of times sleep standing up, you know, so, and they don't sleep nearly as much as we do, but if during the night there's no activity or anything, they'll stand there and sleep a while. But horses in the sunset, just, oh, what a pretty picture that is.
Yes, certainly beautiful. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading The Horse Lover?
Well, you know, I have hoped that it would raise some questions by the readers. The readers would say, well, you were doing some special things with those horses. You were doing it in a different way than anybody else. And some of the things that you were doing, the horses really responded well to, and why can't the government do some of the things you're doing? And I've kind of hoped that the book itself would build a little platform so that people would say, can you give some advice to the BLM? Can you, you know, show them how you did it with love rather than just with these are objects and we have to move them from place to place like chess pieces on a chessboard.
Precisely. Right.
So I've kind of hoped that would build a platform that people would say, okay, you've proven by your actions that you know a lot about the horses, and, you know, how can we get that knowledge that you have in into the BLM so that they can do a better job with the horses. Another thing, a small goal, not nearly as lofty as that goal, but in writing the book, I wanted the reader to feel emotion. I wanted them to laugh. I wanted them to feel happiness. I wanted them to feel sadness. You know, I wanted them to the gamut of emotions that we have.
Yeah.
I would like to think that the writing will bring forth those emotions in the reader. And I hope that proves to be.
It certainly did, because it was beautifully written, and it is from the heart, and I certainly encourage people to buy the book because it's such a beautiful, beautifully written book from that perspective. Where can someone go to buy the book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, the book is available at a lot of Barnes & Noble stores, although I went to the Tucson Barnes & Noble just the other day, and they only had one copy, which I thought, here I'm local, and they should have more than that. But it's available on Amazon.
Yeah.
And Amazon has real rapid service, and Amazon has a very nice web page about the book, you know, with some reviews and what all.
Right.
And so Amazon is a really good place to get the book, and it's readily available, and so that probably is the easiest. And what was your other question?
Where can they get more information about you and the things that you are currently doing?
Yeah, go to the Horse Lover. We have a really nice web page that we update fairly often. It's not just a static one, but, you know, we keep updating it. And there's what I think is a nice web page. And then if you read through it, it gives you blogs and it gives you Facebook and things like that. And but just the web page, the Horse Lover, is, I think, a well-done web page.
Yes, it's beautifully done as well. TheHorseLover.com.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Wonderful. We're coming close to the end of the hour.
Are we at the end of the hour already?
Yes, sir. We're coming close to the end of the hour. And since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners?
Oh, boy, you know, that's... that one's a little tough. I was lucky in life. Is I always did what I wanted to do, meaning that I was my own boss. I created everything around me. You know, I instead of me letting other people tell me what to do, I kind of was lucky enough that I could create a place where I could let my creative juices flow, and I guess what I'm kind of going in a circle around is I really hope more people can do what they really want to do in life and not what they're kind of forced to do. But just, you know, I loved ranching, I loved horses, and I was lucky enough to be able to make my living by being with the very things that I loved. And that's a gift, and not everybody is lucky enough to do that, but follow your heart and do things that make you happy.
Beautiful. In short, basically, don't be afraid to create. Don't be afraid to follow through. And let it be heart-driven.
Yes. You said it far better than me, Johnny, so thank you.
Alan, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Renee Mullen Masters. She is the creator of You Are Smarter Than You Think program. Renee and I will be discussing the amazing success her program has received in the last 14 years. This led to the release of the third edition of Renee's book, You Are Smarter Than You Think, earlier this summer. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Alan, it has been truly a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.